Welcome to another episode of Mastering Herbalism with Bob Lindy of the Tradition School of Herbal Studies here in beautiful St. Petersburg, Florida. In this podcast, we work to raise the bar for anyone, beginner to practitioner, who has an interest and excitement for herbalism. Join us to explore the exciting world of herbal medicine. Today, we're going to talk about diet. And before we get into that, remember, of course, anytime you hear something that seems to relate to what you need to be doing, make sure you consult an herbalist, an ND, MD, AP, or some other interesting set of initials for your own personal health journey. And nothing I say is approved by any federal, state, or local government agency and does not constitute medical advice. But I bet your great-grandmama would likely approve what we're going to talk about. So, talking about diet, it's always fascinating, the idea of we're going to see an herbalist, we feel like something's out of place, out of balance, we don't feel well, we haven't gotten the care what we want from the medical industry, and maybe you're even working with the MDs and using medication or blood work, surgery, whatever, but you want to take a more natural approach in addition to it. And the reality, all of it, whether you're going to see an MD and taking a more traditional route for your health care, or whether you're seeing an herbalist or an acupuncturist, if we don't address diet, there is not enough herbs in the world to get us to that place of feeling somewhat balanced. And the reality is, with all the social media, all the different ideas, there's so many crazy ideas about that have no history, no tradition, no science to really back up what's out there. And so whether it's everybody needs to eat an alkaline diet, or everybody needs to be a carnivore or a vegan, or the 30 banana a day diet, that's really a thing. This idea of I like to think I know stuff, but the reality is I can't even keep up with all the new diets that are coming out and all of the things that are problems being created by these pop culture kind of ideas. So I wanted to take a little bit of time in this episode to really talk about how we can start that process and kind of find our way through the weeds to get to some really basic, sustainable ideas about our diet. And the reality is, when I say diet, that oftentimes sounds like we're restricting ourselves, we're taking the joy out of eating. But the reality is, when we talk diet, it's really about how we eat, something that's sustainable for the rest of our life, that we work uniquely with an individual. And even with that individualized idea of these foods are good for some people, but not everybody, there are some general ideas that we see cross-culturally. So we see it in Ayurvedic, we see it in Chinese, we see it in literally, I make jokes at the opening sequence there, like your great-grandmama, this is the way she would have done things. And so let's look at those tried and true traditional things that are also supported by the science that can move us towards a place of healthy, sustainable dietary practices. And I think that's really important when we're thinking about this. I like the idea. There's a Chinese proverb I remember learning in school, and it's, of course, a bad translation and the best I can do, but anyone that takes medicine and neglects diet wastes the skill of the healer. And so that idea that, like, you can take all the prescription meds or the herbal medicine, you get all the acupuncture and massage, but if you're on a garbage diet, it's kind of pointless. And so we're going to start at kind of the most basic thing and work our way to some things that we can practice, some things, whether we're talking about seasonal fast or cleanse, there's some unique ways that I think mixing a little Chinese and Western that can make that a sustainable thing for everything. So, the idea that I read something recently that all you have to do is fast for 72 hours and it'll cure cancer and diabetes and all this other stuff. And the reality, there's something to be said for fasting. And when we look at the religious practices, there's oftentimes we don't eat certain foods on certain days, no red meats on Fridays kind of thing. Or there's, you know, if we look at Ramadan, we're excluding all food for a particular period of time. So we do see in some cultural religious practices, there are periodic fasts of either all food or specific foods that we have to be careful for. And there's ways to do that because, you know, we have busy life. We got to go to work where access to good food is always challenging, you know, and the cost of foods have gone up. Our access to foods has gone down. So we're going to break that down a little bit. So I'm going to start with there is no single right way to eat food. And there's some ideas of those things that mess up our digestion a little bit. So even if you have the best food in the world, you grew all your own vegetables, you ate seasonally, you ate variety, if you're stressed out, that's going to affect your diet. And so that interrelationship with our emotional health, with our ability to digest and extract the nutrients from our food is very important. And so I want to just talk a little bit about that first before we actually get into the specific foods. And this idea of, you know, making sure you chew your food, that, you know, the Chinese proverb that, or statement that the teeth has, or the stomach has no teeth, is true. But science actually tells us that digestion starts even before it gets into our mouth. And so it starts in the pan or in the pot, and the preparation of the food becomes important. So there is the cephalic phase or the mental emotional phase of digestion, which is triggered by the sounds, the smells, the aromas in the air, all of that action of preparing our food that creates 20% of the digestive juices in our stomach. And so it starts to produce the hydrochloric acid that we're supposed to have in our stomach. It gets the bile secretions going, the pancreas is starting to put out all that good stuff in preparation for it. And some of you may remember in like high school or something, you heard about Pavlov's dog. And it was all about dogs learning to respond to the sound of a bell, that they would ring the bell and they were trained to that they were going to get fed, so they would start salivating. But what that was really also teaching us was that salivation was those dogs' brain preparing them for the reception of food. So in this society where we can microwave things in a minute, that we can get Uber Eats, we can get things instantaneously, that we're no longer cooking our foods or preparing our foods ourselves, that we already are starting a pint low, that we are not preparing our body for the reception of food because we're missing that cephalic phase or that idea that the sights and smells are telling our body to start the production of those digestive enzymes. So the very first thing I would say is looking at that slow food concept of taking as long as possible, and even if it's, you still throw the food in the microwave, but chop up some fresh basil, and that chopping of the basil, the smells that come out from that, make a little curry sauce. And so that cooking it in the pan, you can just pour it on your microwave food. You know, it's fine to do those kinds of things. But something that helps with that process of creating the meal to prepare for that digestion. The stress aspect that comes in there is when we look at the vagus nerve. We talk about the stress, the HPA, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal complex, and how if we're stressed out, our body goes into this fight or flight. So long-term stress affects our body so that if my running joke is if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, your ability to poop, i.e. eliminate, your ability to digest food is no longer important. The only thing that's important is running away from the saber-toothed tiger. And so in this last 5 years, I don't care who you are or where you are, we've had a lot of stress with COVID and all the other things that are going on, that long-term stress has almost become the norm. And so we're all every day from the moment we wake up in the morning to whenever we conk out at night, we're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger from everything around us, the news and so forth. And so the production of hydrochloric acid, and that is the primary digestive enzyme that's in our stomach. It is an acid that can literally eat a hole in a tabletop. Will stop the production. And so we see a lot of low stomach acid. And so managing our stress, one of the things we can look at, and I'll leave it to everybody to Google, there's a number of really easy ways to strengthen the opposite of fight or flight. That's the rest, relax, and digest. And that's controlled by our vagal tone. That's the vagus nerve, and the strength of it is the tone of it. So we can do things like belly breathing, singing, chanting. Those are all things that are really helpful for creating a place of relaxation that allows us to digest, eliminate, rest, and so forth. So making sure that the dinner table is not a place where we're doing confrontation, that we're turning off the TV, especially the news, and, you know, setting a tone, light a candle, work with a good china, put a flower out. All of those things can help set a tone for our body's ability to digest our foods. And I'm going to start the next part when we're consuming is the idea of chewing food. I come from a long line of people who never chewed their food. We would start talking and we're just as fast as we could reach for food. We were stuffing it in our pie hole and we're talking with our mouth full, all the things that your mama told you not to do. I was doing it. I went into the military where the running education that we got about diet there was put your face in your plate and suck. So for somebody who was already not chewing their food, I became ever so aggravated. And as I learned this idea that our digestive process, the chewing of our food is part of that, slowing down, and people say, you have to chew every single bite 40 times. I'm like, if I chew it once, it's a miracle. So that's great if you're able to do that. But my favorite trick is if you're using a fork, put your fork down between every bite of food. But I can safely say that didn't work for me. I would do that maybe half the time. So my secret that I teach my clients this all the time is chopsticks. I happen to stink at using chopsticks. So if you have to use chopsticks to get every bite in, your hand will start to cramp and you have to put it down. And you're going to get very small amounts of food. So it helps you slow down your meal a little bit to use chopsticks, no matter what you're eating. So that's an easy one. The next part is the idea that, and I remember learning this in acupuncture school, 100 steps after every meal live to be 100. And so this idea that although peristalsis, which is the contractibility of our intestines, and it is we put food into our stomach and it's broken down by those digestive enzymes and the hydrochloric acid, and it empties into our small intestine, and that it's now called chyme. The peristalsis, which is the contraction and squeezing through the small intestine into the large intestine, is part of that digestive process. So we have muscles and the nerves that all control that. The reality is part of that process is actual movement. So if, you know, Thanksgiving dinner where you overeat everything and then you go and sit on the couch and watch the ball game, that there's zero movement after these major meals, that there is no part of the physical movement of our body that is helping to move that food through the digestive process, through the digestive tract. So it doesn't have to be a fast walk. It's not even exercise. It's go for a leisurely stroll after, I would say, major meals or whenever it's possible. This is also a helpful process. Now let's talk about a little bit about cooking our food. So one of the things we always talk about in Chinese medicine and in Ayurvedic medicine is the idea of cooked foods. And so think about it. If you caught the flu and you called up your mom or your grandmama and you're like, oh, I'm sick. I feel so bad. I don't even have the strength to cook anything. And they go, oh, I'll bring over some food. If you were actively sick, would they bring you a salad or would they bring you a pot of soup? Most of you would say a pot of soup. So as we're struggling with our health, we feel imbalanced. We literally feel toxic or sick. we should be looking at those foods that are the easiest to digest, the easiest to assimilate the nutrients that are in that food. And so it doesn't mean that raw food is bad, but usually we talk about 80% cooked, 20% raw. There's nothing wrong with having some fruit or something else, but that idea of making that digestion easier on our body is important. Remembering that we have many ways that we can cook food. So one way is with heat. We make a soup or we put it in the oven or whatever, but we can also use fermentation. So things like sauerkraut is very different. Cabbage is raw, we call it coleslaw. But if we ferment it, all of a sudden it's pre-digested for us, you know, not to mention the good digestive enzymes, the probiotics that would be in there with active culture if you made your own sauerkraut. So that's one way to cook your food. The other thing is we can do a marinade. So ceviche, we add an acid to it. We use citrus or apple cider vinegar. That's another type of cooking process. So knowing that the stovetop is not the only way to cook or break down your foods to make it easier to assimilate the nutrients. The reality, some foods are broken down and the heat is a better way to get to the nutrients. Other nutrients can be depleted through cooking. So something like vitamin C, the more we heat it, the more it breaks down. Sulfur, the second we pick a vegetable, the sulfur compounds start to break down in there. So that also speaks to a fresh vegetable. And so some things like your dark green leafies, think kale and cabbage and many of your cruciferous vegetables are best cooked. And so honestly, if you're doing a pot of collard greens, especially if we look at tradition, it's cooked overnight and there's acid added to it to help put those minerals that are in those dark green leafies into solution so that we can best absorb it. So think about cooked foods, especially if we're fatigued, especially if we don't feel well. I would say cooked foods are most important in the wintertime, and you can increase your raw foods and fruits more in the summertime when it's really hot out. The other part that we can think about is the seasonal foods. So making sure that we are eating the fresh vegetables and seasonal foods. My favorite example of that is, well, I have a few, but I'll give you two of my favorites. Asparagus. You know, if you're lucky enough to live in a place where asparagus grows easily, it's this wonderful spring green that's kind of got this bitter, pungent, and sweetness to it, and it's so specific for the liver. And we oftentimes, you hear people talk about liver cleanses, spring liver cleanse, and so forth. And so asparagus is one of my go-tos. Forget all the herbs for a moment. Asparagus is herbal medicine. And so it is best in that first thing that comes up almost through the frost in the early springtime. As then it comes up, we gather that up, and we do a light steam to it, a light cooking, and consume it to help with the liver. But the other time that we see is in the summer, especially in the late summer, watermelon grows, the hottest time of the year. And watermelon feels so good. Here in Florida, where August and September is painfully hot, nobody wants to go outside with the high humidity and the high heat. And so nothing tastes as good as watermelon, and it's full of minerals, it is full of water. And even if you just like picked it right out of the field, you break open that watermelon, you stick your hand in and scoop it out, it feels cold. And so energetically, it's very cold. And so that the right foods grow at the right time. So making sure that we're eating more of our cold foods and our fruits are more in the summertime. Our fresh, bitter things are in the springtime. In the wintertime, we eat the root vegetables that we stored in the root cellar, or our preserved foods are cooked into soups and stews in the wintertime. So we can really think about the seasonality of stuff. So nowadays, we can get every food from every corner of the earth at any time of the year. And that's fun, but not always the best thing in the world. The other thing I would say is if you're able to buying and consuming those things that grow locally. Here in Florida, although we have a great citrus industry and there's a number of other industries like peppers and tomatoes, there is a limit to those things that are native here that we actually consume here in Florida. So obviously, long before the Europeans showed up in Florida, there were people living here and surviving on all of the wonderful foods, the cooked greens, as well as fruit and so forth. And many of those are no longer utilized. So those aren't part of the normal diet. And I always encouraged it to learn about those edible plants in your bioregion. And, you know, that what that is varies tremendously. But anywhere from within 10 miles to a couple of hundred miles would be considered bioregional. So there's a lot of southeastern plants, but I would say here in Tampa Bay region where I am, we actually see more of the tropical and subtropical plants. And so for me, I really put a lot of emphasis on learning our native greens here. And we have things like Biden's Alba, the Spanish Needle. We have tropical chickweed. We have some of our tropical fruits. We have go-to cola. These are things that we can eat as part of our regular diet, our hibiscus. So many yummy vegetables that are here that we completely ignore. So eating locally, eating seasonally. And now this is very different the way a lot of people talk about it. Eat a variety of different vegetables, different proteins, different fats, especially thinking about different flavors and colors. That always seems weird. We're like, what should I eat? I was like, eat as big a variety as you can. And if we eat different colors, we're also going to get different flavors. So you should be looking for some sort of bitter vegetable, some sort of sour vegetable, some sort of sweetness. So that can be a root vegetable or a fruit, or most meats are considered sweet and or salty. Something salty, that can be, many vegetables have kind of a salty. Celery is a great example. And then using our herbs and spices to create an acrid, spicy, and bland. All of those can mix in there. But also think about color. When we're talking about vegetables, there's purple, orange, yellow, green, dark green, white, red. All of those different colors are going to have a different complement of nutrients that will start to fill in those micronutrients that we need for so many different functions. And we hear about, you know, anthocyanins in our purples and blues are good for the eye and the circulatory system, and our reds are good for the heart and circulatory system and for prostate health. But the reality is there's no single color or flavor that we need more of or less of. It's about getting the variety. So think variety. See what's fresh and seasonal. See what grows in your yard. You know, my running joke is always like, stop mowing your yard. The city may not like you or your neighbors, but you don't need to plant a garden. It's already there. So try to learn about those things that are already growing in your yard and incorporate some form or fashion of those into your diet. So that's kind of the basics, is thinking about variety in color, flavor, and season. Make sure that we don't just think vegetables, that we focus on different proteins. And so especially for folks who are eating a vegan diet, and they were like, oh, this vegetable or this seed or this nut is high in protein. The reality is most of those things are incomplete protein. So they have a variety of amino acids, but they don't have all of the amino acids that you need for healthy immune system, healthy bones, muscles, and so forth. So the greater the variety of protein-rich foods will get you all of those amino acids that you need. But that takes thought and effort. I would say that there's also, like, somebody who's like, I just eat fish or chicken, or I just eat eggs. That's great. Those are really great sources of complete proteins. But every single meat protein still has different ratios of nutrients in there. Some are higher in iron than others. Some have more B12 than others. Some have different trace minerals, also how they were raised and so forth. So eating all the vegetable proteins, and I would say if you're eating meat, eat all of the meat proteins, not just one or two. Really think about that idea of variety. As we look at fats, we can not just, oh, I eat avocado and olive oil. Think about all of the oils. Think about all the seeds and nuts that you can incorporate and explore ones that you've never tried before. Again, variety, variety, variety will literally make for the healthiest person out there. So now let's talk about some of the, you know, yay, I'm perfect. I eat all the flavors and colors and variety, and I only eat organic and seasonal and local. So you're doing great and you still don't feel good. So probably a few of the things that I really see that throw off the digestion, you know, we talked about stress. And so with stress, we oftentimes see low stomach acid. With aging, we oftentimes see low stomach acid, low HCL. With the overconsumption of alkalizing supplements or drinks, and I know I'm saying some trigger stuff right now, but your pH changes from your mouth to your anus. So you have a very acidic stomach. It's at around a pH of 1 or 2. And anything other than that means that you're not absorbing, you're not breaking down your proteins, you're not getting the benefits of B12, you need stomach acid for that, you're not getting your minerals like calcium, magnesium, and iron. So acid is important in your stomach, and then it becomes more alkaline as it goes through our digestive system. If you have a pancreas, which hopefully everyone does, that has alkalizing agents in there that change it from a very acidic stomach acid into a very alkaline as it enters into the small intestine. So if you're taking sodium bicarb, baking soda, to make yourself more alkaline, and many of your alkalizing supplements have sodium bicarb in there to do just that, you are potentially destroying your ability to absorb nutrients. If you're drinking alkaline water, and water is usually around a pH of around 7.2-ish. I've seen 10, the pH of 10 waters being sold. That is destroying your digestion. It is creating candida. It is creating small intestinal bowel overgrowth, and it's stopping your absorption of nutrients and putting you at risk for all kinds of interesting food poisonings and so forth. So make sure you have good stomach acid. And if you're experiencing acid reflux, that can be caused by any number of different reasons. Low stomach acid, high stomach acid, structural issues like a hiatal hernia where your stomach kind of pooches up above your diaphragm can also cause it. So generically, of course, always see somebody who can do some proper imaging and don't assume you have any one of those. But doing a scope, an endoscope, can tell you if you have a hiatal hernia, or imaging can tell you if you have a hiatal hernia. But just because your doctor looks down your throat with an endoscope doesn't tell you whether it's high or low stomach acid. And that's really a problem. So our symptoms oftentimes move us into that direction of understanding. If you have acid reflux and burning when your stomach's empty, you honestly might have high stomach acid. It's not very common, but it does happen without a doubt. If your acid reflux is worse when your stomach's full, it's very likely that you have low stomach acid. And you can experiment with this a little bit, just paying attention if there's specific foods or times of the day when we're seeing the most stomach acid. The reality is, if you take HCL pills, and that's literally a pill, and it doesn't cause any discomfort or pain, you probably have low stomach acid. If you take it with food and you get this horrible burning, there's a good chance you either have a hiatal hernia or you've got high stomach acid, in which case you can fix that really quickly. Take a little baking soda and it will quickly relieve that little bit of excess stomach acid that you put in there. If you're on acid reflux meds. Those are your PPIs and H2 blockers. That is suppressing your creation of hydrochloric acid. If you're on that long term, please, please, please check your B12 levels the next time you get blood work and check for your iron, not just ferritin. You need to check for ferritin, iron, iron saturation to ensure that you are maintaining a healthy amount of those. And when it comes to B12, the range is depends on what scale they use and what test, but it's like 300 to 900. What I tell all of my students and my patients is if your B12 is under 500, I literally don't know how you get out of bed in the morning. So ensure that you're at the higher end of that scale, and not that we want too much of any nutrient. I would rather see you too high than too low. If you're in the 200 and 300s, you probably need to consider doing an injectable form of B12 at some point. If you, every once in a while, you take a Tums or an acid reflux med because you went and had too much fun, honestly, I don't care. But if you're taking that every day or more often than not, you have to correct that or you're going to see a continuing higher risk of a number of disorders. So if we, you know, if we think about what is the role of stomach acid, besides breaking down our proteins and our ability to absorb B12, it is also helpful for sterilizing our food, especially if you're eating raw food or juicing or anything like that. Your food comes with lots of bacteria and fungus on it, and it gets sterilized in our stomach. And so if you don't have stomach acid, you're passing through into your small and large intestines all kinds of stuff that doesn't belong in there, creating what we call gut dysbiosis, but it also has the potential for greater risk of food poisoning, greater risk of C. diff, which can literally kill. We see that a lot of elderly get killed from C. difficile, which is a bacterial infection that can just cause all kinds of messy stuff. So if you're like, man, every time I eat out, I get food poisoning, you probably have low stomach acid. If you have an ever-increasing list of foods that don't agree with you, cause bloating and acid reflux or a cough, there's a good chance that you have low stomach acid. So really investigate that. There's lots of information online. I've talk about it frequently. And it's unfortunately not a test that you can do outside of it just experimenting with HCL. And although I have my own preferences on certain brands, they're all kind of about the same. So HCL is HCL. Just make sure it's in a capsule. That would be the other thing. If you found that apple cider vinegar helps your digestive issues, that's an acid. That's around a 3 pH. And so that if that has helped you, you probably have low stomach acid. All right. So what other things can we look at? So food sensitivities are a huge issue. And I would say that I have seen a greater increase in food sensitivities being a huge part of people's health picture, and it is a huge roadblock for people getting well. Even if they're doing the herbs and they're doing the lifestyle stuff, if they have not worked to eliminate those food sensitivities, and I'm finding my list is continuing to grow that I discover, and I feel your pain. It's usually your favorite food. I literally have a running joke. One of the questions I ask most of my clients is like, what's your favorite food? And whatever it is, I'm like, stop eating it. It's killing you. What do you hate food-wise? Whatever that is, you need twice as much. And so I make jokes about that. But the reality is it's also usually true. Not always, but usually. And I can safely say that things that are triggers for me personally, gluten is generally not my friend. So bread and pasta, up there on my list of favorite foods. Corn is not my food. Literally, I have been eating popcorn as my late night snack, happy family thing. And I find that I am becoming inflamed every time I eat it. So now corn is on that list. Dairy. What's not to like about dairy? Cheese is all of our favorite food frequently. And so those are the foods that I like the most. Those are the foods that cause me the most discomfort. I started getting smart and I like crunchy things. So like corn chips and popcorn, of course. So I was like, let's find a healthy alternative. And I looked at nuts. So I've been eating a lot of nuts lately. Now, of course, because for the last couple of years, I've been using that as my snack. Now I'm sensitive to nuts. So this brings up the idea of leaky gut, which gut permeability. It's inflammation in the digestive system that can be caused from stress, overuse of steroids or anti-inflammatories. It can be caused from overuse of antibiotics and a host of other things. But those are the biggest drivers. And even though I haven't used a lot of those, stress has been this reoccurring theme. And so that probably has a big role for me, and maybe exposure to some toxic chemicals from the military and so forth. So that idea of discovering what your food sensitivities are and working to eliminate them. And it's one thing you can go and spend literally $1,000 for food sensitivity tests that are usually pretty accurate. They sometimes, if you can't figure it out just by analyzing your diet, that may be worth the investment, because sometimes it's like egg yolks, but egg whites are fine. And those tests will oftentimes actually tell you about that. And if you eliminate those, then like, yay, you start to find you're getting better. I find there's two approaches: looking at how you feel, keeping a food diary of everything that you eat, put in there how your bowel movements are, how your sleep is, how your emotional health is. You can even track your weight if you're comfortable with that. I know if I eat something I shouldn't, I'll literally put on 3 pounds. It's inflammation and water weight that I'm retaining. And so that will, no change in diet or caloric intake or exercise, if I eliminate those inflammatory foods, my weight immediately goes back down to normal. So if you keep a log of that and you're like, all right, let's eliminate this food and see how I feel. As you do that, you'll find more and more foods that once they're removed, you feel better. Usually 2 weeks is the magic number. Eliminate a particular food category for 2 weeks. And my favorite part, then go and eat a lot of it. If you're like, I wonder if gluten's a problem for me. My fingers swell up. My joints are achy. I'm fatigued. I'm not able to focus. I don't sleep well. Emotional health goes down the tubes if I eat too much gluten. And you eliminate it. Like, you do your research. You eliminate all the gluten. And then after 2 weeks, go and have lots of pizza and bread and pasta and just enjoy it for one day. If you don't notice any difference, you're mistaken. Gluten's fine. If you feel like you've been hit by a truck, you probably need to stay away from it. So looking at that health is, and finding those food sensitivities is very important. The other thing I'm seeing increasing in its commonality is nightshades. And those are things in the Solanaceae plant family, potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, peppers. A lot of people just say green peppers. It's green peppers, red peppers, orange peppers, hot peppers, spicy peppers, paprika. All of those are nightshades. Goji berries are nightshades. Ashwagandha is a nightshade. And tobacco is a nightshade. There are plenty of other more obscure things out there, but really trying to pay attention if those are a potential problem for you. I'm going to talk about one more thing, and I'm going to say bone broth, and for the vegans, they're not going to be a fan of the idea of bone broth. But bone broth is a great way to repair the gut. If you've been dealing with gut permeability or leaky gut kind of issues, bone broth is a good way to get nutrients into you and help to slowly start to repair the gut. If you're dealing with osteoporosis, if you're dealing with anemia, if you're dealing with deficiencies overall, then bone broth is a great thing. For those of you who eat a vegetarian or vegan diet, you can do a really intense mushroom broth, and that becomes almost the same. I won't say it's exactly the same, but you can play with it a little bit. We're going to talk about some herbs that you can add into that. And so the secret to bone broth, yes, you can go buy it at the health food store. I would argue that that is rarely the best that you can get. It is cost prohibitive oftentimes, but it is convenient. So I'm going to say, yeah, you can buy it. I'm going to encourage everybody to make it. The best way to do it is in a crock pot. I've not worked with the Instapot, but I understand that's good. But I like the old school slow cooking. Although you can get a single type of bone, a lot of times I encourage people to get, again, variety. So get chicken and fish and beef and venison or whatever you've got access to. Ideally, it's organic or wild caught, that it's free ranging if it's a domesticated animal like a cow or a buffalo these days. Perfect world. I'm going to give you perfect world, and I'm going to say you do the best you can. So not everybody has the time or ability to do all of these things. But it's good to take those bones and roast them in a high oven, like crank it on as high as your baking setting will go, bake them for about 20 minutes, and then broil it for about 15 minutes. We're actually trying to get some char on those bones to help break it down and release the minerals that are in the bones. I like to add a bunch of stuff because it's not like I'm just going to do shots of bone broth. We can add it into a pot of rice. We can add it into our stir fry. We can use it as a sauce base or a soup base. So add garlic, add onions. Seaweed is a small amount of seaweed is a great additive because of all the trace minerals that are in the seaweed. A little salt and pepper is wonderful. All the mushrooms, they're all good. And whether those are ones that don't break down like a reishi mushroom or a button mushroom or a shiitake, whatever is your favorite mushrooms, throw as much in there as you can. I'm a big fan of beets. I think there ought to be a beet in there, but you can also throw in carrots and celery and all the other good stuff. I'm a big fan of beets for a variety of nutrients that are unique to beets, like betaine is very high in there. You can put dark green leafy vegetables in there, and all of that stuff gets put into a crock pot, covered in water, bring it up to high to bring it to a simmer, and I like to add herbs into that. And so if you're working with an herbalist, which ideally you are, you can find herbs that are specific to you, especially those root vegetables. If you're using ginseng, ginseng should be cooked to death. If we're working with other nourishing herbs like astragalus, attractalodes, romania, all of those, angelicas, throw all of those into your bone broth pot. And ideally, cook for 3 days. That's a long, oh, and I forgot. And add some apple cider vinegar or some other acid in there and cook it for 3 days. Add more water if you need to. Doesn't matter. A lot of times I'll say on the last day, if you're there to monitor it, take the lid off and let that water evaporate off a little bit. And then it gets a little bit more concentrated. That's helpful. Then go ahead and strain off any of the parts that are in there. Squeeze it really well. If you've got any vegetables, get every drop of liquid that you can. And then put them in kind of pint or small containers. You can freeze some, and then you put some in the fridge. And so if you do about a quarter to a half a cup every day, that's a great way to ensure that you're getting this wide range of nutrients to nourish the body. And there is glutamine in there will help to stimulate the bowel growth to repair that gut permeability issue that might be there. And there's a classic that we sometimes add to a congee or kitchery, but I'm a big fan of putting it into bone broth, and it's 8 treasures, and you can vary this however you like, but it's a couple of chi tonifying herbs or nourishing herbs and a couple of blood nourishing herbs. And so the amounts can vary, but you know the Chinese like the magic number 9. It's the largest number because after that you have a 1 and a 0. So I would say generally 9 grams of each of these, but you can change the ratio of these herbs based on your needs, how big of a crock pot you have, and so forth. So ginseng, remembering Chinese ginseng is warmer, American ginseng is cooler, Eleutherococcus isn't truly a ginseng, so very dry. We can use the Japanese ginseng, Taizi Shan or Prinseng root is more moistening. And so there's a couple of options in there, but we're going to generically just say ginseng. Attractalodes, poria mushroom, astragalus, jujube dates, but any date will do in a pinch. Dongguai, romania, white peony root. And that combination kind of helps everybody a little bit. There's other things that we can add or subtract in there. Sometimes something that has movement in there, like salvia, danshen, or xuancheng, which is ligustricum, something that starts to move the qi or the blood. Citrus peel is great to add. You're not limited to a certain number of herbs, but that is a classic combination that we just said. And obviously, if you're on a lot of meds, use caution, work with an herbalist. If you're pregnant, I would definitely use caution with this and work with an herbalist. Don't be throwing any of that stuff in there if you're dealing especially first trimester pregnancy. But ultimately, if you're just run down, this is a common combination that does really well in the bone broth and just keeps an earthier flavor in it. So it's still enjoyable to make that as a part of your diet. Quarter to a half cup every day, every other day. I personally usually encourage people to allow the fat to come to the surface and remove that. Some people like to keep it in. If you don't do well with fats or you're missing your gallbladder, make sure you remove that fat. It will actually cause some diarrhea or stomach upset. Usually because this is so nutrient dense, start with a smaller amount in the beginning and work your way up to that half cup or even a cup if you really like it. It's totally okay. It's all food that you're eating, so it's pretty safe. So remember, food is your most important medicine. It's the thing you do three or more times a day, and there's 1,000 other things that we could talk about. So the quality of your food is certainly paramount. Eating seasonal, eating fresh. If you can't get fresh, go with frozen. Work on the different flavors, the different colors, more cooked than raw, and variety, variety, variety. And enjoy your food. Work in a restful, relaxed mode. Go for a walk after your meals, a saunter, if you will. And all of your prescription medicines, all your herbal medicines will work better. And ideally, you can work on not needing herbs or prescription meds as we create a nourished, healthy body. So, as always, I enjoy our podcast and each of you spending time to listen to either myself or my guests and the podcast Mastering Herbalism with me, Bob Lindy of the Tradition School of Herbal Studies in Florida. And I hope that this podcast helps make you ask more questions, raises the bar for whether you're a practitioner already or just starting to dip your toe into the herbalism bathtub, if you will. So novice to practitioner, if you have an interest and excitement in herbalism, I hope this helps you learn more. If you're interested in learning more from me or any of the great teachers I have at Tradition School of Herbal Studies, you can learn more about the school and all the classes at traditionsherbschool.com. And remember, all of our classes, or most of our classes, are offered online live. Even if you live away from the Tampa Bay area, you can catch all of our great classes and explore some of the different approaches that we take and some of our bioregional herbs in here. Also, if you're interested in the clinical practice of seeing one of our great practitioners, myself or any of the others, you can find out about that at Acupuncture and Herbal Therapies. Our website is acuherbals.com, acuherbals.com. And of course, special thanks to Tyler and June from alchemist.com for making this podcast possible. Their professionalism, recording equipment, editing, and all the other cool stuff that they do has allowed me to join this century and get this information out to more people who need it. And make sure you subscribe, that you join us also on YouTube, and I hope that I see you in some of our other classes and that you enjoy all the great upcoming and past episodes of this podcast. So be healthy and enjoy your herbs.